The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with great value travel insurance online at supervalue.ie.
My first guest on the programme today is an Irish man who's promoted some of the giants of music at various venues in the UK. He helped revive the famous Glastonbury and Reading festivals. He brought Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Van Morrison, etc. to Finsbury Park in North London. He put Johnny Cash, Paul McCartney and Roy Orbison on at his original Mean Fiddler venue in West London. And he also organised James Brown's last ever performance. Today he's fighting for the jewel and what remains of his once lavish crown. It's a pub on Ladbroke Grove in Notting Hill in London. Vince Power, how are you, Vince Power? Are you all right?
Hello, how are you, Dave?
I'm doing very well indeed. Good man, Vince. Let's just go to Ladbroke Grove in Notting Hill in London and tell us, what's so special about that pub?
Well, it's a very old pub. I've known it since the 60s. It's a big pub, big corner site. It's a big community pub. It's, you know, it's every type of person goes in there. It's very rare to see in London today. A lot of pubs have been gentrified.
So is this in a place where, like, money has come in and they want this out? Is that it?
It's just on the edge. It's just pushing up from Holland Park, Notting Hill, and you got Ladbroke Grove, which has got the little sort of oasis of, like, what goes on around that area of about 200 metres.
All right. Well, now you are talking to us from the BBC in London this morning, and you've been there many years. Waterford is a long time ago. I'll get to that in a little bit later. But this place here, it does have a very interesting history, a lot of Irish connections, even before you were involved in it.
Yes, it has. It was way back. It was built to cater for the navvies on the Great Western Railway, which was built went through Ladbroke Grove.
And what was it? Was it always a pub? Was it always a hotel?
It was called a hotel. Yeah. It was called a hotel, but it was never a hotel really. It was just a sort of bed and breakfast place. It's a big old pub. It's very famous for lots of things.
One of the things is it's the first place Tom Jones ever played a gig, wasn't it?
It was. Tom Jones used to pick up the glasses there when he was a young lad, and he's sang for his supper.
He'd sing for his supper. He picked up the glasses. So did John Christie, who's the serial killer. He used to. You didn't know him back in the 40s, did you?
No, not that old, Dave. I'm getting that way, but you know.
Okay, so like the kind of people that go there. I mean, are we talking everybody here and down through the years? Are we talking all types, and you can all be equal in this Kensington place?
I think you can. It's unique in that sense. It's from every different ethnic group. I mean, Ladbroke Grove has been that place for many years. When I came to London in the 60s, Ladbroke Grove was the place where all the Irish came, West Indians, Poles, everybody was there. And all the families have grown up there. I mean, the pub has seen like four or five generations of families come in.
And what about you, since you've taken it over quite recently? I mean, was one of the things that you added to it was live music? You're always the live music guy.
Well, I only do things for live music, really. I mean, I wouldn't have any interest in just having a pub, which just people just came into, just like a pub with no music or no activity to do with some creativity in the pub.
And would you say, as others would, that really the community wouldn't come together if this pub wasn't there?
Absolutely. There's a lot of also people who walk the street and they're quite vulnerable, you know, there's nothing wrong with them apart from being built like from care in the community. And these people use the place regularly and meet and, you know, some people wouldn't be let into a pub in Notting Hill or that surrounding areas.
And from your point of view, how hands-on is your involvement?
Well, because of my own personal circumstances a couple of years back, I mean, I'm hands-on 15 hours a day, maybe 6 days a week. And I think that's the success of it, because if you're sitting there thinking and watching, and then you definitely get it right.
Okay, the pub itself, what's the actual name of it? I mean, like, is it the Kensington Park Hotel, the KPH, or does it have another name?
Short, yeah. So it's called KPH. It's the Kensington Park Hotel outside the door, but people called it KPH. In the 70s, it was always known as Keep Paddy Happy, but I think that's not very good. It's not a hotel. No. It has never been a hotel.
Yeah.
Since it was built in the 1860s, 1865, I think. It's never been a hotel. It's got many, many rooms. It's got a theatre room upstairs, which we use a lot for various different shows. It's 100 capacity. And downstairs, it's a big island pub, a traditional early Victorian pub.
And what kind of music are you putting on there at the moment?
Well, we put everything on, really. We do a lot of sort of stuff I've been doing all over the years, a lot of singer-songwriter stuff. We do small bands upstairs. I suppose on a typical Saturday night, you'd get the mixture of Motown and reggae, some soul, and probably a bit of Bob Dylan chucked in and Van Morrison.
And what? Speaking of Van Morrison, you were there in Belfast the other day, were you?
I was. It was a good time.
And was that a special pilgrimage for you? You had to see Van on his 70th on Cypress Avenue. Is that it?
Well, I was invited, so I wouldn't dare not come. I was invited to. He also had a sort of private birthday party in another place, and I was invited to that as well. So I felt very privileged.
Right.
To be asked.
Listen, I might get back to that in a second, but I just want to say, like, you know, the great musical legacy of Vince Parr, it's Vince Parr that we're talking to here, 51551. I'm going to get to that too, but KPH then, we'll call it that for the moment, the Kensington Park Hotel, yeah. or Keep Paddy Happy. What's the problem? You know, there is a problem there at the moment. Like, you know, you're in trouble with it, or what is it?
The problem is it was bought from the breweries, the pub co's, pub companies we call them here. It looked like a really good potential. It looked like it was on his last knees. So the freehold was bought by a company of developers. Like the judge said, they didn't have much regard for the tenant. They just wanted to get the tenant out because the place was on his legs, really, last legs. So I was got the opportunity to run it for the actual leaseholder under the power of attorney because the leaseholder himself, an Irishman who's been there since the early 80s, wasn't well. So I took over and ran it. I opened it last December 2013. And turned it around. It took me 6 months to turn it around. In the meantime, the developers had already applied for permission to change it into an estate agent downstairs and also to put some penthouses upstairs and very luxury flats.
Mm.
So I got the community around and we applied to the council for a local law, which is called a community asset value listing, which stops any potential developer from pulling it down overnight, because this is what's been happening in London at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is that going to succeed, this asset of community value?
Well, it'll slow things down. I mean, you know, that's one side of the sort of campaign we have, and the other side is to actually get the lease reinstated. So yeah. That's subject to appeal. So,
and then this weekend, the property company that owns the building is going to terminate the lease. Or at least that's what they want to do. And this stay of execution is what you're looking for. Yeah,
we've got a stay because we got a short stay because the courts haven't dealt with the actual permission to appeal it yet.
Right,
so that will take another couple. I think we'll be there for another 5 or 6 weeks in any the worst.
No matter what happens, 5 or 6 weeks at least, and hopefully maybe 5 years, who knows? Or maybe, like, and it's very hard to stop the gentrification, as they call it. Very hard to stop the money, very hard to stop the tsunami of the amount of stuff that costs so much money in London now these days. Could this be your last stand, Vince? I mean, is this in a kind of a Custer kind of way. You're surrounded in some ways, but you're damn well not going to go down without a major fight.
Well, I've been fighting all my life. I think there's always fight in something. I don't normally say, turn over and say, okay, get on with it. I always like challenge things. I've done that all my life, rightly or wrongly. I mean, I've been in licensing hearings because of festivals, you know, Reading, Leeds, Glastonbury. They've all been challenges. Hop Farm has been a big challenge at fighting the authorities to get things done. But, you know, I love a fight.
You love a fight. Well, listen, just going back to the past, because we are talking here to the legendary Vince Parr, there's certainly been a fight in the past too, and you always seem to win in those days. I mean, like, everybody will know the Mean Fiddler. Well, certainly people who follow music, and we used to be over there quite a lot as well, and all the Irish music festivals, etc. You were born in Waterford, one of 11 people, one of 11 kids in the family. Four died in childhood. An amazing story. At 16, you go to London. Did you go straight into a furniture business in London?
No, I didn't. My aunt picked me up from Paddington and she took me to Hemel Hempstead. And my first job was in Woolworths, just trainee manager or whatever. I was 16 and a half. I hated that place. It was very, I don't know, I didn't like it. So I stayed about 3 months in Hemel Hempstead and came down to London and got a flat with a room, I should say, with a friend of mine who came over from Kilmac Thomas in Waterford to be with me and for both of us to be together. So he was a school friend.
And what about the music? I mean, like, if you did leave at 16, was music a big thing in the Power household back home in Waterford or in Tramore direction, or did you discover it in London?
No, I mean, it was always in me. I always loved music. I mean, we didn't have very much access to music out in the country, but, you know, we had a couple of albums. We had an old record player. We had the radio. But we had my cousins and uncles, and my grandfather was a great songwriter locally, a good fiddle player, hence the main fiddler.
Right, and you went off to Tennessee. Is that where it happened? You just took a trip there and you said, right, the sound of Nashville. Well, I love it. London needs yes. The sound of Nashville.
Well, I mean, that was, like, I was doing well in the foundation. That was further on. That was around 1979, 80, when I used to go back and forth to Nashville and buy albums and take them back. And that was just a sort of hobby. And then one night I was in this honky-tonk bar. With a few Budweisers, and I decided this is what I want to do. Really good. There's nothing like this in London. Really good spit and sodas place with very, very good band and cold beer. Cold beer was unusual in pubs in London in the late 70s, 80s.
Well, actually, there's a few texts here, Vince, at 51551, and one of them says, I lived and worked in the KPH as a student in 66 and 67. Rough place then. The landlord was called George. He was from Drogheda. did you ever come across George from Drogheda? Probably not.
No, okay. That was before my time.
Okay, and here's one here from Tom in Kildare. Says, ask Vince, what did you give Van for his birthday?
I've given him nothing yet. What can you buy a van?
A man who has it all. I think, another one
I
says,
think you can actually, you can open that one up to the listeners.
I saw the Dubliners there, great night, etc. And etc. There's a few others just about the KPH. But just going back to Mean Fiddler stuff, was it much of a leap for you, you know, from the confines of the Mean Fiddler in Harlesden, if you like, to major music festivals all over the UK?
I think it was a gradual thing. I mean, we opened at Mean Fiddler in 82. And it was disastrous for the first year. I think I did things that I thought people would like, and I obviously liked it myself. You know, some niche acts, and that was bad. So that got me into trouble financially for a year. And then I changed it around, you know, got some good people around me. We started putting on more alternative music and also putting on some good Irish music. So it wasn't a sort of honky-tonk after 83, really.
Right, but you had people like the Pogues and Billy Bragg, and, you know, you had up to Roy Orbison and Johnny Cash. You had big names going on there.
Well, all that was it was, the timing was good as well. We, you know, the Pogues were just about to break, and they did loads of gigs at the Mean Fiddler. You know, I remember we paid the Pogues 25 quid for their first gig, and I think I suppose rolling on at 89 when I started Reading, we paid them 50 grand. To headline.
Wow. So, 25 in the Mean Fiddler, 50 grand for Reading.
Yeah, so they got the least and the most from me.
Yeah, right, exactly. And by the way, the Mean Fiddler in Dublin on Wexford Street, that one didn't seem to work out very well.
No, it's a difficult work in anything. I mean, I've tried it in Glasgow, I've tried it in Dublin. It is difficult. The success of a live music place is the booker, the person who's there, who's got the contacts, who's got the ideas about what the place should be. I mean, at that time, I was around 97. I was very, very busy. We had other venues. So
yeah,
it kind of fell by the wayside.
Because I used to do the Fly in London for you for about 5 or 6 years in a row. And I was also a Mean Fiddler too. I used to go over on Sunday nights and play music there as well. I mean, like, it was all happening.
I know.
And about 10 years ago, or less than that, in fact, you got a CBE. For what exactly? You were awarded a CBE for your what? For your contribution to live music?
I don't know. I was surprised, to be honest. I remember the day we got the letter from the palace, and it said that, you know, we're minded to give you CB if you were minded to accept it. So I thought about it for a couple of days, and then I spoke to my kids, and I thought, well, you know, all my kids were born and reared here, and I thought it'd be to be respectful. I was totally surprised. I don't really know why I got the CB. I think it's much more deserving to other people who help people in the community, people who are, you know, the unspoken heroes, who are carers and people like that.
Sure.
Which is, I mean,
but having said that,
I put it in the drawer and I haven't seen it since.
All right, but Vince, like, I mean, like, let's face it, like, in terms of just the way a lot of people like music these days and the whole community aspect of it, and basically I'm talking festivals here, you helped popularise festivals in the UK with the rise of Reading, as you've mentioned. There was Leeds, the Phoenix, the Flas, I mentioned Madstock, and other one-offs as well. Like, you know, didn't you do the Sex Pistols reunion in Finsbury Park?
Yeah, we got known for doing reunions. We did Madness, we did the Sex Pistols, we did a couple of other smaller ones. I can't remember, but we did the big Oasis shows in Finsbury Park.
Yeah,
I think what we did is we took a different view. When I took Reading over in 88 and our first Reading in 89, I took a complete different view. I hadn't been to a festival before. I think I went to Roskilde in Denmark. And they seem to be light years ahead of what was going on in the UK. I mean, festivals of warm beer that you chuck at the band if you didn't like them. So we took a whole different view. And then we started putting festivals back to back, which was a good idea.
But like you mentioned Roskilde there, but like also Benicassim, you know, moving into Europe, I'm thinking particularly of that, of Benicassim in Spain. Was that just the next logical step, just keep going?
Yes, I mean, what happened with Benicassim was I liked Benicassim previously before I sold The Mean Fiddler. And when I sold The Mean Fiddler, I had the ability financially to be able to go there and buy it because I was barred from doing anything in Ireland or England as part of the deal for 3 years. So I just got on the plane and I retired for about 2 weeks. From the time I sold The Mean Fiddler to buying Benicassim was about 2 weeks.
And like the Benicassim Festival, like there's like 150 acts would play 4 days, 4 stages, free camping 8 days. There's a beach in the day. There's music at night and that. I mean, it's been voted best overseas festival for a lot of reasons. And I'm just thinking of all the stuff that you've had your hand in and started so many different things. And like, did you get the reward that you really should be getting out of all of these things? Like, why did you sell the Fiddler? And when did you sell it?
I sold the Fiddler in 2005. I decided I would sell it in 2004. It was a public company then. We were very big. We had a 400 staff almost, and probably had 7 festivals. We did a lot of the dance festivals. We had restaurants. We had most of the gay clubs in the West End of London. It was huge. I just wanted to get back to... It was just a on-the-moment decision, really. I didn't sell it because I wanted a huge amount of money. I just
One of the festivals that I haven't mentioned too much about, I mean, in terms of not so long ago too, and a lot of people will know it, a lot of people won't, is the Hop Farm Music Festival. And if you think about that one, people were surveyed as to what they want at a festival, and you know, festival people who like going to festivals, and they just always felt, look, we're the lowest of the low in terms of like what people ever think. You know, people don't think of us necessarily. They told you what you wanted. You set up the Hop Farm Festival, and once again, award winning. I mean, like, do you get the right claps on the back there, Vinny or Vincent, or just go, does it?
I don't need them. I think I do things for myself, and then other people happen to. I thought, well, you know, festivals have gone too VIP and too exclusive, and there was glamping and all this kind of thing, and really the real punter, the real music fan was ignored, I think. And I decided, okay, this is an opportunity to try and forget the sponsorship, forget the branding, just do a festival which is all about the music, and a festival that's really accessible, and you can go from one stage to another stage in 5 minutes. I mean, the Hop Farm was the ideal festival, and, you know, we got sort of acknowledgement from people like Patti Smith and Morrissey and Prince. Even he said that this was the best festival he'd played, but you know, it was a huge financial loss. Yeah. That's the other end of it.
But you see, like, that's the funny thing. Like, I remember, like, obviously Woodstock in 69, and then there was Woodstock 30 or 40 years later, and it was just branding everywhere, and that was the huge big difference. So would you be the kind of person who would hate or dislike sponsorship or branding? Or, like, can a modern festival really survive without those things?
I know. I mean, on the other side, me and Fiddler and myself, we took the biggest sponsorship ever from breweries and various different telephone companies. So I would be a hypocrite if I said I hated. I just thought it had gone too far, where you go into a festival and you see all these beautiful marquees and a security man outside saying, you've got a pass, but you haven't got the right pass. And you normally get that.
God, I know that one, all right.
You normally get that backstage someplace, but it was actually in the arena you'd get.
Yeah, that's just silly. Yeah, I know, good point, all right. And also, you had the under-12s since the festival's creation. I mean, the Hop Farm one would get in free, and that would encourage a lot of people to go who mightn't have thought of going. Hey, I can go with the kids and it's good and safe. Like, it's a different kind of community family thing, a lot of these things. And you've had Blondie and Prince and Peter Gabriel and all those. But, like, did it go wrong in some ways, do you think, Vince? I mean, like, you know, it's not as... you're not as involved as you were, and things have often just slipped through your fingers. Or did you just let that happen?
No, I was very, very hands-on at the Hop Farm. I think what happened is, as a promoter, you know in the first 10 minutes when you announce the show and put the thing on sale, you know your fate. You just try and readjust it to make it break even. But, you know, I could spend all day here explaining as to why each festival didn't work. But again, it's my responsibility. It didn't work because of lack of ticket sales. At the end of the day, you know, Prince didn't. He didn't sell out. It was a decision whether or not I'd put him on 6 weeks before the event. Even though we talked about it 6 months before the event, it took him 6 weeks before the event to say, "I'll do it now." And that temptation was irresistible for me to say, "Okay, that's another $1 million." And when you do it in your head, a promoter always justifies themselves. Herself and said, "Well, okay, you know, that's only so many, that's only another 5,000 tickets at whatever, 150. So more bars, you get more bars, more merchandise." Mm. And you say, "Yeah, perfect." But, you know, the fact is, 6 weeks before, people didn't believe that it was happening because it was such a big act. And I think we didn't reach our figures, and you end up with losing a couple of million pounds or something on it.
Yeah, indeed. By the way, there's a text here at 51551 from a guy called Mick Quinn. He said, "Who is this guy, Vince Parr? Why is he not featured in Irish festivals if he's that famous? Just check up your history. He's the man." "What a nice, humble man," says another one. "Refreshing. Vince put on a mighty gig in Tramore in 1993. That's from Pat and Tip. By the way, are you involved down there again? Is it a city of culture or an area of culture or something for 2020?
Well, I've been asked by Waterford Council to be a sort of ambassador for the European City of Culture for 2020. The idea this time is to have the three counties, like Waterford, Kilkenny and Wexford, to combine bid. So I'm Waterford's ambassador for that, whatever that means. I think my input into the music side of it would be... That's what I'll be doing.
Right, indeed, yeah. There's one here that says, "Why was there a picture of a thigh outside your office in the Mean Fiddler?"
It was my friend John Minahan, a famous photographer in London, who's photographed all the very famous people. He had a special camera given to him by one of the camera companies to take a huge camera to take a picture of the whole population of the village of a thigh, and it was a rainy day, and I was on my way from Dublin to Waterford, and he asked me if I would come and stand there. And if you see the fat bloke with the white top on, that was me.
Was it now? Very good. "I saw Ray Charles at Tramore Racecourse standing on a ditch. Ask Vince about Tramore." There's a bunch of them about Tramore. "Vince put on a mighty gig in Tramore in 1993. That's from Pat and Tip. Can you remember those gigs, yeah?
I can. That was probably the best festival and the worst one financially that I've ever done. But, you know, it was a lot of happy people there, but not enough of happy people. We our break even is about 40,000 people. I think we got to about 20 something. Half the people spend their time down in the town, like, because every publican in the town got extensions and put on their own bands.
Well, you mentioned the photograph anyway, there, I mean, with you with the hat, and you did say FATs. Well, here's what I'm saying, you're FAB. Vince Power is so fab. Ireland's 20-something immigrants of the 80s and 90s found a little bit of Ireland in London's Mean Fiddler, listening to Mary Black, etc. And the flea, as the fleaad, as Capital Radio used right. to call it, was mega. All the best to a great man. That comes in from Judy. And there's a bunch of others there, like in terms of, tell Vince, thanks for introducing me to the brilliance of Pierce Turner at the Mean Fiddler in 1989. That's from Deccan. Yeah. Cork, that goes back, all right. Yeah. So, just like you know, do you enjoy now running the pub that you're there, looking at all the customers still coming in, and knowing that this could go at some stage?
Well, I'm resigned to the fact if it goes, but you know, I haven't given up the fight. But yeah, I really love it. I love people. You know, I mean, that's why there's a lot of people I've become to like and respect in the KPH. Customers who come in, some are not, doing too well in life, but you know, this is their sort of little refuge to come in and listen to music and have some good beer and pizza.
Do you know, funny thing is, Vince, could you have got out earlier and before the recession hit, before the mad money even came into London to this thing now? I mean, even in terms of the festivals and all the rest, could you have?
Of course I could. I mean, I got out with a lot of money. I sold it to our friend in Dublin, Mr. Desmond, Dennis Desmond, and we made it on my, but money's never been the issue for me. I've always felt it a little bit embarrassing, really, having so much money. I think I work better without money.
There's one here, actually, just speaking of money, it says to Vince, why don't the bands take some of the hit if they don't sell out at a festival? That's from Tommy in Waterford. Is that just a lovely text, but a bit naive, is it?
That's a dream story.
Yeah,
I wish they would.
I'd be
very
like
rich.
That. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. No, I don't think that's the way it is, you know. Spent many a good night in the Mean Fiddler in Harlesden in London. Great venue. Rough area, though. That's from Dee in Wexford. In fact, one of them here says, I worked in the Elgin pub across the road in the 70s. It was also known as the GBH. right, okay.
Yes, that's a very gentrified pub now.
Is it?
All nice carpets and booths and
is that what's happening all over London now? It's just money, especially in places like Kensington.
Well, every place really. It's not just Kensington. I think there's something like 16 pubs have gone from the area of Ladbroke Grove and Notting Hill in the last year. There's a loophole in the planning law that you don't need planning permission to change a pub into a retail clothes shop or an estate agent.
You're still a music fan, I presume, Vince, yeah? Like, who are you listening to at the moment, or is there anybody I should know about?
Oh, I just listen to some of the new stuff. I listen to all the old stuff. I mean, if I'm left to my own devices, I would listen to people like Otis Redding, I think, Neil Young, Christy Moore. I love Christy Moore, and of course Van. I don't get as much chance to listen to stuff that goes on at the festivals. I like Hozier. He's a really good artist. I listen to everything, really.
And Van was special on Monday in Belfast. Yeah, it was a spiritual night.
He made it a bit spiritual. I went for the last show, the late show, and that seemed a bit spiritual. I think he was marking time with a lot of stuff he was doing. It was kind of a long sort of song. He was doing some sort of like a speech, half a song.
Yeah.
But he's a very modest man. I don't think he wouldn't have been comfortable, really.
No.
A few more here.
I want to mention, as an immigrant to London in 1961, I was warned about that place, KPH. I crossed the road to avoid Dublin thugs hanging about. Then in time, I got to realise human worth of that part of North London. Back there last year, all changed. New money and Russian oligarchs, etc. That comes in from Kevin O'Connor. Good man, Vince. He kept me in pocket money for a year after I left school in 1980, playing late night trad in the Mean Fiddler. Always a gent. That's from Michael in Leitrim. Vince Power had another great little pub in Harlesden called The Bar. Some great music there also. Love the Fiddler in the 80s. That comes in from Trevor. So there's a lot of good ones. Had you forgotten that one? Yeah, so many in the portfolio. Yeah. Okay, so look, we're at Van, as I say, on Monday. That takes us to this week. You're going to go out now, rush out and buy him a present now that you've been outed because you didn't buy him one. So basically, the autobiography, there is a book coming out. James Brown, that's the guy I see on TV quite a bit on Newsnight and stuff, talking music, etc. He was Loaded magazine, etc. Is he helping you write the book? Is he?
Well, the book is book is written since 2005. James,
oh, it's that book. Oh, I thought there was some new stuff coming up about all the last 10 years. All right.
We've got to sit down and rewrite it because the last 10 years have been as interesting
as the previous
20 years.
Yeah.
So, I will write it. I think it's some of it. I mean, it's difficult to write. I don't want to write a book about stories about artists, so it's difficult. I think I might just fictionalize the whole thing and write it. And
fictionalize the whole thing? There's no need to. Why write fiction when the truth is 10 times as interesting? No need to be doing
sometimes that. Sometimes the truth is hard to write about other people.
Right, indeed. Well, listen, look, Vince, I wish you the best of luck with the KPH, and I hope it goes very well, and the locals getting behind you as well, and onwards and upwards. So, Vince Parr, listen, Vince, thanks a million for talking to us on the programme this morning.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, take it easy. Good on yourself, Vince.